All right, welcome in to Wilberforce Initiative podcast edition. This will be episode one. We're going to be discussing. I'm here with Adam Oxen and Ryan Polk. My name is Curtis Winkle. We're going to be discussing Rod Dreher's article in the American Conservative called The Benedictine Option. So I'm going to outline the article here. It's kind of a provocative idea. Dreher goes back and questions if we are in the West and in America turning into Rome in some ways, and obviously a lot of parallels have been drawn there, but with bureaucratic gridlock, moral decay, massive public debt, some different parallels again we could draw with the Roman Empire, the late Roman Empire, and Dreher cites this Benedictine and kind of the monastic movement grew out of that time period, and so wonders whether this is a time for Christians in the U.S. to consider something like this, what he calls the Benedict option. And so this would, from there he goes and sets up kind of where we are culturally in this time and place, talking about, he mentions the great forgetting where youth are moving away from the faith in droves, and so could this be a possible reaction and way to maintain the faith among our youth, which I definitely want to talk more about later. And then he draws out a couple of interesting examples of what he considers maybe forerunners of this movement, a little community in east of Tulsa, about 3 hours from where we are, and then one in Alaska as well. And these two communities, they homeschool their kids. They're kind of a loosely, if we want to use the word monastery, it's very loose. They're just kind of a small community, rural, not necessarily full-time farmers, but I guess he alludes to them being kind of on the same page theologically and wanting to kind of having the same goals for purifying the faith and making sure their children grow up in it. So, all right. So just initial reactions, guys, on your first reading. Ryan, we'll go to you first.
Yeah, I thought the article was really interesting. Appreciated the history and just trying to figure out what he thinks the goals are. I mean, is the goal to live separately in order to demonstrate the gospel or to protect the gospel? What's the mandate that they find to do that, and then even are they finding that it's successful? Like, does it even actually work? Historically, we know that the monastic movement didn't succeed. So, what's the end game? What's the long term goal on it? I guess.
Adam.
Yeah, I agree with Ryan on what is the end term goal and. Also, whether or not my question would be, is it actually a valid biblical answer or solution to withdraw in such a way? I mean, when Jesus was praying for his disciples, John 17, he said, "As you sent me into the world, I have also sent them into the world." He didn't say, "I've sent them into rural, withdrawn communities so they can, focus on themselves." So, but at the same time, I think the article, what I found compelling was the Benedictine monasteries that talked about being these kind of cultural lights during the Dark Ages. And I don't see them as being withdrawn. They were teaching how to farm, how to build, how to build culture. And so I don't know if that's happening in these places. Maybe it is.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's great. That opens a good topic for us. So the monastic movement born out of, I kind of considered it, and I went back and read a couple things about it being evangelistic in nature as well, where they're kind of moving north into the kind of Celtic areas and they're sort of outposts of Christianity.
The Benedictines.
Some monastic orders. Okay. Yeah, I don't know if it's the Benedictines or not. But But yeah, so in my mind, there is an element or a strain of them that is, like I said, evangelistic in nature. And that's kind of what the article points to a little bit, saying, you know, their hope, or a hope, I guess, of this new movement, he concludes with, would be that people would kind of grow weary of postmodern darkness and see these communities as bastions of light, beacon on a hill kind of deals. But now, why do you say, Ryan, you said the monastic movement we know failed. How would you explain that?
Well, I think we probably ought to be careful, and the article may have helped us a little bit with this, but, you know, that's a pretty broad term when we talk about, like, the monastic order. I mean, it wasn't like a monolithic, singular deal. I mean, you had all kinds of monastic movements during that time, and some of them were like the Benedictines, and others were very individual. You know, like a guy would take the monastic order and would go, like, live in a tree, essentially totally separated from everyone because everything was so sinful, and that was his only way of communing with God, he thought. But really, if you just from a broad picture, painting with big strokes, historical standpoint, it was really Luther and the Reformation that said, let's take Christianity out of these cloisters and into the culture. And so, you know, Luther was actually kind of leaving a monastic setting in life, went very public, and then the Reformation kind of flowed out of that. So I think Dreher's argument, though, would be, yeah, that's exactly right, but they were kind of the glue that bridged maybe 500 to 700 years in between that. And they did do some incredible things. And one of them that we can probably be grateful for is even like preservation of scripture during that time. So that's a good thing. So I just say ultimately, though, you know, there's just a lot of factors, too, like technology as culture advances and some of those things, you know, like the isolation position that the monastic orders brought seem to be a little more difficult. You know, those lines get a little blurry, you know, as well. And so
he kind of addressed that with the guy telecommuting in the community in rural Tulsa, not having been able to get the type of work he was doing in that area, doing it via the internet.
You can be totally separate except for swing dancing.
I definitely want to get back to that. But okay, so let's talk about whether that's a biblical idea just real quickly. So that we have things like the Great Commission and the beautiful feet, like you go and bring the good news to the nations. And so Dreher, I guess, would see this as, I mean, like I said earlier, I guess there was an evangelistic thread to the monastic movement, and that they're building monasteries in places, and I guess trying to draw the community to them. I don't know what their means are, but there's a purifying element where there is like a withdrawal kind of.
I thought what was interesting about the communities is it was talking about them living together in neighborhoods around the church, and going to all the services during the week. Really, I thought it describes most churchgoers. I mean, we've lost the, you know, the church in the middle of the city and the whole town around it, which is kind of what seems these communities are trying to get at. But you can still have, you know, this idea of community and people coming to the church and it being a center of their lives without geographically being located there. That was one observation I made. I thought the experience wasn't that much different from like what we have here at Trinity. Because we don't live, I mean, we've got a 15-minute, 20-minute drive, and, you know, we feel plugged in and a real part of the community here. But getting back to your question of whether or not it's biblical, I mean, I think there is some insular part of being, you know, part of a Christian community and being a part of the church where you do meet, but we do have to be, you know, salt and light where we're at in our own neighborhoods. That's a great opportunity to not live, you know, in a neighborhood of believers. We can live in our own neighborhood and we can add to, you know, the community that's developing there. And so, same within our jobs and vocations. So that's my wondering about that. My question is, you know, do you have as many opportunities to invest in other people's lives outside the church if you're just cloistering altogether, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing we probably ought to think through a little bit too is just, you know, everyone's going to bring some kind of theological presupposition to the table in regards to these things. And the monastic orders have always been a little more associated with Catholicism and kind of a Catholic understanding of the faith. And Dreher comes from that background as well.
Orthodox, I think, right?
Yeah. And so that, I mean, as opposed to like evangelical Protestantism, which is going to view the evangelistic call very differently. So this would seem like, rather than evangelism being kind of a, the highest order you go and tell, that and that's kind of the evangelical kind of way of looking at it, this is more of a look and see, and we're going to, so I think, you know, like the evangelistic imperative is still there, that thrust is there, it's just kind of performed differently. I mean, I think that if you ask this group, I don't want to speak for them, but like, they would say we are being salt and light. We're living so differently as to attract.
Yeah.
Whether or not that's what, you know.
Out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, whether or not that's realistic.
I know, but that's kind of it brings up the question of, is it the Pharisaical thing? Like, you make yourself clean and then come be with us? Or is it, you know, we'll, on the flip side, you know, we're going to come be a part of your community. As Christians, we're going to go out and be parts of neighborhoods, communities, businesses, and we're going to associate with you, and hopefully our salt might, you know, the gospel will go forth and make them clean, you know.
Okay, so let's, he mentions I think he calls it the new monasticism, which I'd never heard that used, to this kind of urbanism movement within Christianity that I know we've read a lot about and seen with the other the Gabe Lyons idea, and I mean a lot of good books, Keller and those guys are writing about engaging in the urban environment and just in your community in general. Let's kind of contrast that with this. What are there? I mean, are the major differences? Are they kind of the same, coming from the same impulse?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I think Adam touched on it earlier with the idea of what that movement with Keller and Lyons and Q and some of this, and then this, what it seems to, where they merge is that there's a desire for some authentic community, dependence on one another, rather than just, you know, very individualistic living, which the church really suffered from for the last, you know, what, 30, 40, 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I think at the heart, what that's really just exposing is, you know, that we're creating the image of God created for those things. And now we're trying to look and figure out ways to accomplish it. And, you know, we notice that the culture is shifting to an urban culture, not Christianity, but culture in general is moving into a urban, city-driven, you know, way of life. And so it kind of begs the question a little bit, like, is the new monasticism not going to be new very long? You know, is it sustainable? You know, when culture is moving. I mean, I have to be honest. When I first read this, I'm like, what would be the difference primarily between these examples that were given and the emphasis on monasticism and like Amish communities?
And I think you would say the technology, right? They wouldn't eschew technology.
I think that's about the only, that, like, as far as like goals and what they're trying to do is essentially, you know, like, we're not going to be dependent on the state. We're going to live off the land. We're going to be around each other primarily, try to live differently in a way that is wholesome and godly and biblical and you know, try to reflect that to culture. So the technology would be probably the difference. But overall, I mean, to me, it's pretty similar.
Yeah, theologically.
I think where they meet and overlap and what I find compelling is what he dealt with in the beginning of the article, the likenesses to Rome, and that, you know, Rome's collapse, you know, people forgot how to read. I'll quote from him. People forgot how to read, how to farm, how to govern themselves, how to build houses, how to trade, and even what it had once meant to be a human being. And then he goes on to say behind the monastery walls, this was all essentially being maintained, you know, and so it was able to reteach people how to be human. And so I think that's what's compelling and probably driving both movements, but I don't know. How is this going to play out within our time and space and culture and society? You know, how is, because I think it is, you really are seeing, like, people are forgetting, like, the basics almost. And
okay.
But not in the same way that happened in the Dark Ages. You know, ours is more, this modern problem is.
Well, yeah, I mean, so we're much more knowledge-based workers. Again, you mentioned people moving into the cities. So we're technologically advanced, and maybe this is kind of there's a thread. Wendell Berry was mentioned, I think, with one of the movements. I mean, this is kind of a back to the land. Let's re-engage with our hands and get back in the dirt and kind of a reaction to maybe hyper, you know, the transhuman. I mean,
man is machine.
We're moving towards evolving into machines at some point. How do we get back to more organic ways of life? That's a heavy term, but is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, for sure. I'm just, you know, I think people are. I mean, we've got, you know, kids, the education system is failing in educate. Like, they were taught, people forgot how to read. They didn't have an education system. We have an education system, and kids aren't learning how to read. You know what I mean? We have a government that's, you know, the way things are going. You know, Rome actually fell and all those institutions collapsed. Ours aren't so much collapsing as imploding from the inside, you know. So it's what it seems to me. I mean, this is open for debate, and, you know, we all get into heated debate about what's going on. But so yeah, I mean, I think there's I think there's those things, and then sure, the man is machine, that we're just you know, we put things in and you get, you know, other things out. That's not the way to look at a man, at a person. You know, men and women were created in the image of God. We're creators, and, you know, so you get all these different things coming into that.
Yeah. Okay. So the great forgetting was kind of center of the article he mentions, and this being, again, youth moving away from the faith, just statistically we can see that. So what do you think Dreher would propose for that? Is this kind of a solution for that? What do you guys think are maybe some healthy reactions to that? Let's go down that road a little bit.
Well, can I jump in?
Yeah, Joe.
Yeah, I take a little bit of an exception with that we're losing our young people. And I mean, I just want to argue kind of from a, because I know Adam loves statistics. So we are losing our young people if we work from the premise that 80% of Americans are born again Christians, like they claim to be. But that's just not a reality. And so if you work your way down to, like, what is actual robust Christianity being lived out, you're probably not losing near as many as you think. So that's one thing to think about. You know, I mean, maybe we're losing it because they were marginal and they weren't, you know, that's what First John talks about. They left us because they weren't of us. And so, you know, so Chesterton really hit on this when he said, you know, we really need to work on converting the lost, and then we really need to work on converting the church. You know, you got to have both and on that in order. You know, and I think that's really a good thing to think about. So I do think, though, that the great forgetting, I think that these movements and what Dreher is moving towards is, and here's the way I read Dreher's article, maybe I missed it, is the great forgetting and this idea that we're losing Christianity, something needs to be done. Here's a couple of ideas. You know,
I didn't think he was really arguing for them so much as just presenting
them. It's like,
them.
Here's some ways that guys have thought through this. And it was kind of like, so do we have an alternative? And so I don't really have an alternative other than, you know, I would probably, even from a historical perspective, take a few issues with. We know Rome fell, right? That's obvious. But, you know, when you draw it all the way to your final conclusion that Rome fell because people forgot what it meant to be human, well, we really saw, I mean, I'm not sure that's fully true. I mean, they fell for a lot of reasons. You know, I mean, it's not as simple as saying, you know, it was a decadent culture that it was a depraved culture. That's where we see what was going on. And
an overstretched military and a lot of...
Yeah, there's a gazillion lessons to learn from Rome for us today. I guess when I come back to look at these movements, though, it's like if they're ideal, they really just seem to, at least on the surface, lack like the biblical one. And that's an issue that I think would have to be addressed a little more. You know, even the things that they seem to prize, right? I mean, like, as far as I know, there's no biblical mandate for you and I to learn to farm or teach our kids at home or move to within a mile of our church community or, you know, these types of things. So I think, you know, we try to peel the onion a little bit and find out, like, what are the core things that are really good and true and need to be pursued, and can that be done? You know, one of the questions I have from the article is, are there goals such that this is the only way they can be accomplished? And I don't think they are. I think that the things that this is trying to produce can be done in a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'd agree. And that's what I think, like you said about him presenting, here's some answers that some people have found. Whereas,
yeah.
You like mentioned Lyons and Keller, like, you know, restoring the city and the common good for the city and that kind of thing. That's a different set of solutions and answers.
Yeah. With its own problems, too.
Right, with its own problems. Yeah. So I think it is a very robust dialogue going on about this. How do we be salt and light?
Yeah, you know, I think you guys are on the right track. I think we talked about this morning, just from good teaching is where godly living must come. And I think that's, like I mentioned earlier, kind of the impulse of both of these is how do we maintain a good, true, full, robust theology, creation, fall, redemption, restoration? How do we keep those things central? And some guys are choosing to do it within the context of an urban environment, which I think I would, you know, initially view as a little bit more healthy, because I think your challenges are going to refine your understanding of the faith and has a little bit more of the evangelistic tradition, which I would fall into. And then these other guys, you know, it was put in the article, you know, one of the kind of antagonists was saying, this is hiding your life under a bushel. This is not... this is not trusting that God will carry his gospel into the culture regardless of if we kind of tuck away.
Yeah, I think, you know, I wouldn't appreciate people who would look at this and say they're not fulfilling something, you know, biblical, you know, because I think they really are trying to do that. I'd say one of the distinctions that might be helpful is, like, it's a difference between Christian living and then living as a Christian. You know, and I think those are different, you know. They're going into this, and it's more that Christian living. This is what the Christian life looks like. Whereas Keller, Lyons, Beath, these guys on Vocation basically say, no, you live your life as a Christian wherever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's an important distinction on that. The other thing that I would say is, it kind of, in the comparison with the fall of Rome, concerns me a little bit, because if you see... if they're driven more by fear that America's going to fall apart, right? Well, then what they're doing makes a lot more sense. If we're going to lose, like, if the economic system's going to crumble and we're going to lose things like technology and our ability to buy and sell and these types of things, then, like, a return to the land, if you will, makes a lot more sense. And that could happen. I mean, we don't know, but I don't think that we should, you know, necessarily be living in such a way that fear is really motivating those decisions, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that that's not underneath that, because when I think about, what it's the one in Alaska, right, that was said it was kind of modeled built on the model of Labrie.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but see, that's really strange, because like Labrie, Schaefer's whole model was not for a bunch of Christians to cloister together. It was really for, I mean, he had some strange, lost characters that would come and live with him. I mean, it was actually just the opposite. It was, hey, if you're lost and you have a question, I mean, he named
work
him,
it out.
It's French for the shelter, right?
Uh-huh.
I mean, come here for refuge. And so it really wasn't the idea of Christians separating. It was actually just the opposite. He went and lived among lost people.
Yeah.
And so I think that that.
And I think that's what's the time we're in is there's all these questions out there. How should we, you know, what is the best way for us to live? What is the best way for us to engage? You know, I mean, if you want to talk about America, like on the worldwide, in the context of like, how should we militarily, should we be, you know, engaged in all these different arenas around the world? You know, all this, like, there's all these questions that we have, like, how should we be involved? And we can, it's a real opportunity for us as Christians to, get to be a part of the dialogue instead of withdrawing. You know, we can get, like, I've mentioned Josh Garrell's really loving his music. Like, this guy isn't making K-Love music, you know, for Christian radio. He's dealing with questions and topics that people across different faiths and beliefs or no faith, you know, can engage with, because he's asking questions and searching for truth. And so he's getting involved in communities in Portland and in New York, playing with like mason jar music, and you know, and he's getting respect both from Christians and non-Christians because he's doing what he does well, which is make music and to write from a sincere and heartfelt position. And so I think if we engage with others in that way, instead of like withdrawing and just, you know, putting up walls so we can protect ourselves and not, you know, feel like we're in a situation where maybe we don't have the answer, which would actually be a really good position for myself and a lot of other people to be in, not having the answer, because then it makes you more reflective of your own faith, you know. What is the answer to this question? I haven't thought this before. There are good questions that we need to ask ourselves.
Now, couldn't Garrow's go make records in Alaska, though? We can engage with the ideas because of technology without necessarily physically being around folks. Now, it's not an embodied.
You know, Portland's a mecca of designers and artists and musicians, and so I mean, he's in the middle of that culture, and that's what he does, you know. But he's also a Christian, you know. So he's a Christian, you know. To paraphrase Lecrae, his music isn't Christian, you know, but he is dealing with Christian themes and life and stuff. So he's engaging with his, you know, with the people who play music.
Yeah. I think that's what I'm drawn to so much more. Why, again, I would lean more towards the urbanism movement, because I think there's something about physical presence that that we may lose if we disengage and withdraw. So, all right, Ryan, last word.
I go back to this idea of at the very best, if we just give the benefit of the doubt to the movement and say this is, you know, it's good, their heart's good, their motives are good, then we'd at least have to say that it's something, though, that some people are called to, but certainly not something that every believer should be thinking about doing, I don't think. And I just keep going back to, you know, Jesus didn't pull disciples and go live somewhere else. Paul traveled to cities and all around the place, didn't go, you know, into this monastic way. We just don't have a biblical model of this at all. So I would say, you know, like, but if the Lord is leading someone to do that, then they should, you know, do that, and like-minded people will follow, but it shouldn't be something we mandate or put that on people, I don't think. That makes sense.
All right, this has been the Wilberforce Initiative Podcast.